Station number 16585, Karen Churchill, Rio 2.
Karen Churchill, Rio 2. Yes, talking about the events leading to the war, Karen, would you have known anything about the meetings of the British Prime Minister Chamberlain with Hitler? Did that come into your awareness at all?
Yes, in fact it did. But from the how our marvellous Führer, of course, the leader, the great God, you see, the great white hope, if I may say that, I'm sorry, this, how he is demonstrating to the world his will of peace and his wish for peace, this sort of thing. Of course, Goebbels, he missed no opportunity for propaganda and build this up. And that we were aware of, yes, yes. It was in all newspapers, of course, you see, and on the radio. Yeah.
Was there a feeling, do you think, you know, I'm trying to get to what you remember, which you do so well, a longing for peace or a fear of war at that time? Was that in your consciousness at all?
I would rather say, in my particular memory, it was a kind of exciting foreboding, neither peace nor war. It was a strange feeling, which I cannot quite pinpoint. And of course, then I was still too young. See, this. But I remember that, and of course, you see, everybody pinned their hope on Hitler, who brought order, who brought work, who brought food, and all that.
But was there any particular feeling about the Soviet Union and communism that you remember?
Not really. Not really. That really didn't come within my sphere of thinking. I was only 9. So that I didn't really encompass at all.
Do you remember the outbreak of war, though, when war started?
Yes.
Could you tell me where you were and your memory of that day?
Yes. It was in September. It was a lovely day. All three of us, my twin brother, my elder brother, we came home from school, and we, on our way home, we went to the local baker, and we had with our pocket money, we were what we always call the offcuts from cakes, you know, this, and that we got for a penny a huge bagful. And then on the radio, the war started. We ran home, I said, my goodness, what does that mean? What does that mean? The war started. That I remember. Then of course, I mean, this is my father and my mother. They felt they were quite white. That is what I remember.
In England, we talk about this phony war period, you know, which occurred, the period until the German troops went into France and the Low Countries.
Yes.
Which was a period in England, as you know, of relative peace. You know an awful lot about war history, I know. What was it like in Germany? You know, what were the effects of the outbreak of war, say, in Dresden, a young schoolgirl in Dresden?
Dresden... Nothing really changed. Nothing changed. And I can't quite remember when the rationing started. The very first years, I can't quite remember when that started. This I can't remember. I should have done a bit more research, actually.
No, it's what you remember which is important,
yes.
And don't worry about the date.
Yes.
But do you remember rationing, you know, as you're talking about that?
Oh, yes.
How strict it was.
Oh, very strict indeed. Because there was no food, you see. And we couldn't get any food from outside. And Germany was almost starved out. And I remember all these, we had these ration carts where the food rationing was divided into three equal parts, what we call a decade. You can buy food for 10 days and then you can't break into the next decade. It is a safeguard so that people do not binge themselves and then starve. So it is a very clever way of rationing the food. And this, I can't remember when that started, whether it started right at the beginning of the war or not. I don't know. I can't remember that. And I know here in England, one had almost unlimited potatoes and I believe bread. I'm not quite sure. We didn't have that. We didn't have that. We didn't have unlimited. Well, the bread was rationed, potatoes were rationed, everything was rationed, everything. So we really, really starved. And I remember that was, of course, then during the war, one thing I do remember, which was foolish, very foolish, these little bread coupons, you know, you had a little bread coupon, you cut out and then you go to your baker and buy the bread. And there were, of course, then these prisoners of war from Russia, you know, they bring people in, all prisoners of war, wherever. They had to work in road gangs and so on, and then soldiers with guns beside it. Silly. My mum, she dropped a food coupon in, whether this poor bloke found it, and then he couldn't do anything with it, thinking afterwards. But somehow, I mean, this is how she was. And
a black market in food, in so far as you know?
I can't remember that, but there certainly was. After the war, afterwards there was black market, I know, because after the bombardment, and there was still, the war hadn't ended. February was the bombardment, the war ended in May. In between, we had nothing, no food. Well, I made dolls and swapped them for bread coupons with the local baker or something like that. That I made, that I used to do, sort of.
And did the state help at all?
Oh, my God, there was no help at all.
I was wondering, you know, did you have advice with nutrition?
Nothing. Oh, you mean during the war?
Yes, or...
Yes.
Vitamins for pregnant mothers, that sort of thing.
During the war, yes, pregnant mothers had extra rations. I mean, during the duration of the sort of isolation against the world, if I might put it this way, within that confined. Pregnant mothers had extra rations, so had workers who had to do heavy physical work, and so had so-called Geistesarbeiter, men or people who use their brain a lot. They also had special rations. So that was monitored and regulated. But it got less and less as the war progressed. You see, there was nowhere to get anything.
So were you often hungry?
Oh yes. I remember my mother, she gave her food to us children, and she was so weak. She was lying, she hardly could get up, so weak she was. Really, really weak. And that of course was then towards the end of the war. There was no food, absolutely no food, you see. And that of course children, they don't look further than the horizon of their home, if I may put it this way.
How about your education during the war, until the bombing, you know?
Yes.
Did that carry on much as normal, or were you getting evacuation? people in.
No. It carried on more or less as normal. And there might have come in some people or there, but our classes, we've always had 50 or sometimes 55 people. Our teacher at the front there, the children who couldn't hear or see very well had to sit in the front and the others at the back, and the teacher saw it all. You had to put your hand at the back, you see, so you could fiddle about there, and then write. Now they talk about, you see, and we all could read and write and do our arithmetic. I mean, my husband too, they had about 50 in their class. So, anyway, our education went on, and of course, unnoticed by us little ones, of course, the achievements of Hitler were, of course, taught, and all these achievements, and how wonderful he is, and we soaked it all up.
Was there a lot of war sort of news coming into the classroom?
No, it wasn't, except the sort of, this has been annexed and this has been saved for the Reich, you know, this sort of thing. We have liberated those people, and that was it, you see. And of course, the children then thought, oh, how wonderful. You see, proud, being aglow that we saved these poor East Prussians from the clutches of the Russians or whatever. You see, so how children feel. I mean, it would happen to any child here. You see, until they learn a little bit more.
How about the radio? You were saying earlier on that you had a radio during the war.
Yes.
Which programmes did you listen to at home? Was it only German radio?
Yes.
You didn't ever have the BBC?
No, that was very, very dangerous. You couldn't. You see, there are, it's also when there are neighbours, you see, in flats. When you have, of course, BBC, my mother probably might have listened, but we children didn't. But you see, there is one... You have to notice, remember one thing. If a family listens to something clandestine, it is dangerous but exciting for youngsters. And in their glowing excitement, they might whisper to their best friend. You see, all that you have to consider. And that is exactly what they were looking out for. It's like in Russia. Or like in these totalitarian states, that is exactly the technique they have learned from Goebbels. Yes. So we thought, well, we better don't. We wait till that comes home and see what happens. What is happening is not good. We knew that. So
could I ask you now about your father, and if you could tell me about his going into the army and what happened to him.
Yes. He went into the army, and it was a broadcasting unit, and he had to take his radio equipment, and he had his horses with him, and he went through the Caucasus, and he more or less went by himself. He was a recording man. He was filming and recording. And I still have, there was one thing. He went into the Caucasus and he witnessed how a young boy was being dragged out of the house and was about to be shot or executed or whatever. I only remember it from him talking. And he somehow managed to stop this. And the mother of this boy had a woven belt. A woven belt is a long piece of woven belt, and she gave that to him. And I have that piece. I still have that piece. I have that, and that is. But he was able to do things because he never went with troops. He was on his own. He was on his own, and that I remember. And then also when he came back home on home leave, you see, in Russia, these peasant hovels, we call, are built almost like the ancient wattle and daub, but with soil and cow dung. And yet cow dung has a when you use that as rendering, almost a disinfecting property. That's why they use it. And also in India. And of course the propaganda, oh dreadful, how awful, how primitive, it wasn't. And my father, when he talks to us at home, he said, well, you will hear this, but it isn't quite like that. So he dared to go as far as hinting, but not further, because in case we say something that doesn't quite go with the official line, and that will immediately prick their ears in investigating. So he could see things and record things, and of course he was far more intelligent than the mass of soldiers who had to go in and do their bit. Which of course they fought extremely brave, I mean there is no doubt about it. And on the wrong side. Shame.
Well, yes. Were you getting an idea of the suffering of the German troops in Russia, or was that hidden from you? I was thinking of that winter of 41-42.
Yes. In fact, we as children, we were employed. Well, it was sort of like here when children knit little vests for the Rwandan babies or things like that. We were knitting palaclavas. We were knitting mittens. We were plaiting out of straw. Straw soles, you see, straw is insulating. It's an insulating material for, and so we were doing this sort of thing, trying to help a little in that way. And then also, of course, the General Paulus was commanding the troops in Stalingrad, and they were all dressed in men. They were all dressed in men. And then when, of course, Stalingrad fell, all these men fell. You see, and there was a hush of mourning over the whole city. That was, this. And, of course, now, listening or reading the historic, this book by The Rise and Fall, which is riveting stuff. And it rings so true, you see. And I believe you read it. Yes. So it answers a lot of questions.
Well, was your father still in the Soviet Union at the time of Stalingrad? Would he still have been there then?
Yes.
With his work?
Yes.
Did he go to Stalingrad?
No, he was not
just
in Stalingrad.
In the Caucasus,
yes.
Because there was a lot of anti-Semitic activity in the Caucasus, I believe. Is that right?
I don't know. But history will probably say so. But yeah. I wasn't aware of it. But as far as I know, the Russians are very anti-Semitic. And, of course, then all that what happened over there.
Yes, I was wondering if he witnessed any of the activity against the Jewish population by the German army, by the SS. Did he ever speak of that?
No, he didn't, in fact. He didn't. Whether he just keeps things under his hat, because afterwards, if I'm now leapfrogging forward a little, is It's like our men here, our sort. They don't speak. They don't speak. They have this all hidden away. It's only sometimes when I go with my husband to the commandos and then they can't stop talking oddly enough, and you've just opened a little. See, it's like that. But he didn't talk.
So did he remain in? Was his work mainly on the Eastern Front throughout the war? Father?
No, he was in France as well. Yes, he was before he was in France, and then transferred to the Eastern Front. At the beginning of the war, he was in France.
Did he have much to say about that?
No. All he did, he brought us home some two little capes, from France. I have a photograph, in fact. My mother and my twin brother, myself, with these capes, and that was taken. Oddly enough, that was taken on the bridge, on the Albert Brücke, the bridge, and we were standing there. My mother was asking a man, a passerby, to take a photo of us, and there were soldiers running past and saying, "Have you seen British airmen?" Pilots or whatever. We just looked, and that was the time when Airy Neave escaped from Colditz. And that was far from up the River Elbe. How odd, you know, these coincidences. That photo there. Talking about, my father was in Russia, and he was wounded there, and his bomb exploded, and both his legs should have been amputated. He was transferred to the military hospital in Altötting, that is in the Bavarian Alps, and then later on, he was in that hospital in Altötting, and the surgeon, well-known surgeon, he saved his legs. He said, "Better have bad own ones than good artificial ones." So my father was then on crutches with his legs, and he had almost 100 splinters extracted from his body, and almost as many were still circulating in him. Nobody could get out, and so we thought, and no splinter, we had to wait till they work themselves either to the service and can be taken out, or he dies. We don't know. That was one of those gambles. But getting on and with. So he then was transferred to be nearer home, because my mother travelled to Altötting and she didn't dare to leave the children alone and this sort of thing. So he was then transferred to the military hospital to Altötting, to Dresden, and that was the hospital in the Große Garden. My goodness. And that was just before the bombardment happened. And of course, he then had home leave. He came home on his crutches, came home, and he was at home when the whole thing started. And of course, the Große Garden, the Große Garden, they called it the Great Garden, a great garden, a beautiful big park, was the reception area, more or less, where all the East Prussian refugees camped out in the Große Garden. Of course, they were fleeing the advancing Russians, and their port of call was Dresden. So there they were, you know, all chock-a-block with their wagons and whatever camping out there. My father came on home leave there on that, and then my elder brother came.
Yes, I was going to ask you about your elder brother.
Yes, from France.
What had happened to him in the war?
Well, he was in France. He was in France, and he also was on the East Front. He also was on the East Front.
He would have been in the army, would he?
Well, he was in the SS. Wehrmacht. He was in the SS. And when I hear him talk, I said, yes, for everyone we shot, we strung up 10 from the lamp post. That should teach them a lesson. Oh, Christ, what happened to my brother? My lovely brother. Who cried when we had rabbits? We had rabbits and neutrals at home. And when one of the rabbits was savaged by a fox, oh, he couldn't stop crying. This tender brother of mine turned into such a vicious man.
Yes. How was it that he ended up in the SS?
Because
your father was against it.
Yes, yes. But then, you see, he was a bright boy and chess champion and. Then would you like to belong to the elite of the Führer? Of course, yes, of course. That's the best honor that can happen to me, to belong to the elite of the Führer. And my father, of course, he was away. And there he was, the next to the man of the house. And his word went. And so he went into her. And of course, what that meant when my father came back, that was almost like a death in the family.
So what happened to your brother in the war then?
He went with his units and he was then he was captured by the Americans from France. He was first on the East Front and then he was in France. And there he was, the end of the war, he was captured by the Americans and he was then brought into a camp outside München Gladbach there. He was there. Of course, we were still in the East. We were still in East Germany. Dresden, Leipzig. He was there. He was prisoner of war in that camp. So he was there. He was lucky not to be with the Russians.
Did he survive the war?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Did he ever talk about being in the SS and
no.
change
no.
his opinion?
No. 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 I think after all that, he kept very, very quiet. He then became... He married. He married a girl from Schwaben, from... And they then built up their own little business, and so he kept very quiet. Very quiet.